Chapter 5, The Sabbath Healing at the Bethesda Pool, Ensuing Controversy. Verse 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now, there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, in Hebrew called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. When it comes to determining the level of the gospel's historic reliability, the story that will end in the healing of a paralyzed man is one of the most fascinating textual units in the Gospel of John. Until the recent discovery of the pool with five roofed colonnades near the Sheep Gate, everyone was looking for a pentagon-shaped pool at first. Many did not consider the Gospel of John to be historically reliable. It was thought to be either allegorical, truthful only in a sense similar to apocalyptic literature, or simply inaccurate, written by someone who was not from Judea and was wholly unfamiliar with Jerusalem's geography and topography. However, both pools mentioned in the Gospel of John have now been identified: the pool of Bethesda, John 5, and a pool of Siloam, John 9. The pool mentioned in this chapter turned out to have five colonnades, as described in the Gospel, but it was not structured as pentagon. There were four colonnades separated in the middle by another, thus forming five colonnades, just as the Gospel describes. It is possible, though unlikely, that the Pool of Bethesda was a ceremonial water cleansing facility, a mikveh, associated with the Jerusalem temple. But today's archaeological discoveries show, if indeed it was separate at all, it was adjacent to the Jerusalem Asclepion. Archaeologists date the recent discovered Asclepion to several centuries after Jesus, but it is built upon the foundation of an earlier Asclepion. There are many good reasons to believe that this structure was situated within walking distance from the walls of the city of Jerusalem proper, and that it was part of a healing center dedicated to the Greco-Roman god of well-being and health, Asclepius. Devotion to Asclepius was widespread throughout the lands dominated by the Roman Empire. There were more than 400 Asclepions, Asclepius-related facilities throughout the empire, functioning as healing centers and dispensers of the god's grace and mercy towards those in need. The god's mythical daughters, for example, included the goddess Hygieia and Panacea. We can hear in their Greek names our modern words for hygiene and panacea, key concepts associated today with medicine and health. Snakes were a key characteristic of Asclepius' cult of health and healing. Even today, one of the key symbols of modern medicine is a pole with a snake around it. Now stop and think for a moment. If this is correct, it may change our perception of the entire story described here. You see, it is possible that the blind, lame, and the paralyzed were not waiting for Israel's God to heal them, but rather for the merciful healing act of Asclepius. Before you begin to think that the above reconstruction is far-fetched, please consider the following. The 2nd century Christian apologist Justin Martyr mentions a popular obsession with Asclepius among his contemporaries, saying, "When the devil brings forward Asclepius as the raiser of the dead and healer of all the diseases, may I not say that in this matter likewise he has imitated the prophecies about Christ?" And in a statement attributed to the 2nd century Jewish sage, Rabbi Akiva, we read, "Once Akiva was asked to explain why persons afflicted with disease sometimes return cured from a pilgrimage to the shrine of an idol, though it was surely powerless." The Pool of Bethesda, Asclepion, was probably part of the Hellenization of Jerusalem, along with several other important projects, such as a Roman theater and a Roman bathhouse. It is probably referring to such Hellenization of Jerusalem that Qumranite devotees, authoring their commentary on the prophet Nahum, wrote, "Where is the lion's den, the cave of the young lions? The interpretation of this concerns Jerusalem, which had become a dwelling for the wicked ones of the Gentiles." In that case, the Pool of Bethesda, House of Mercy in Hebrew, does not have to be a Jewish site at all, but rather a Greek Asclepion-affiliated facility. It is very important to notice that in this particular healing, Jesus does not command the one he healed to wash himself in the pool. While in the story of the healing of the blind man, he did issue a direct command to go and wash at the pool of Siloam, in John chapter 9. It therefore appears that while the pool of Bethesda was a pagan place, an Asclepion, the pool of Siloam was indeed connected with the Jerusalem temple. Of course, Jerusalem was the center for the Judaeo of Jesus' day, but it was also the center for Hellenized ideals in Judea and was under strict Roman control. Waiting for the moving of the waters, for an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the waters, stepped in was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. While some modern Bibles still include the above text in the brackets, it is not contained in the earliest and most reliable manuscripts available to us today, and therefore should not be treated as authentic. It seems that the Christian copyist, unfamiliar with the cult of Asclepius and the pool of Bethesda's affiliation with it, added the explanation about the angel of the Lord stirring up the waters in an attempt to clarify things for his readers. In reality, he ended up sending all the following generations of readers in the wrong interpretive direction, missing the whole point of the story. Contrary to popular opinion, ancient scribes were not always accurate in preserving every jot and tittle of the text they were copying. They did not embellish things, but certainly were not afraid to clarify issues when they thought something was missing. Hence, the new character in the story, the angel of Israel's God, was added by the well-meaning but misguided copyist. The copyist, unlike the author of John's Gospel, was not aware of the Greek religious identity of Bethesda. Verse 5. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm going, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed, and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Two types of people were often seen on the porches of the pool of Bethesda: those who came to try their luck as part of the quest for healing on the way, as it were, to another promising healing solution, and those who had already given up all hope for any kind of healing. In the response to Jesus' question about whether or not he wished to get well, we read an answer that was anything but hopeful. In the words of the sick man, "I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I'm going, another steps down before me." The stirring up of the water was likely happening when the priests of the Asclepius cult opened the connecting pipes between the higher and the lower portions of the pool. The water in the upper reservoir would then flow into the lower portion of the pool. As the Gospel tells us, this institutionalized man had been for a long time situated in the context of a deeply religious, albeit Greek, environment. He was a man with a significant personal need, and he was without hope. In Greek mythology, Asclepius was known not only for his healing and life-giving powers, but also for the attitude of benevolence to the people. This made him one of the most popular divinities in the Greco-Roman world. Later in the story, in Israel's temple, Jesus would meet the man he had healed and would warn him not to continue his life of sin. This fits well with an idea that the pool of Bethesda was an Asclepion. This is a powerful story. Sickness, the symbol of human chaos, was called into order by the power of Jesus' word, in the same way that the pre-creation chaos was once called into the order of creation by Israel's heavenly king. Now, the royal son of Israel's God, Jesus, came into the pagan abode, Asclepion, and healed a Judean man without any magical formulas or spells. Jesus did so simply by telling the man to get up and walk. In other words, Jesus healed the man in the same way Israel's God once created the world, simply by the power of his spoken word. Now that day was the Sabbath. So the Udayoi said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed." But he answered them, "The man who healed me, that man said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is that man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in that place. Afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Udayoi that it was Jesus who had healed him. It was a Sabbath. We read in the verse 10 that once Jesus healed the man, commanding him to get up, pick up his bed and walk, the Udayoi objected to the man carrying his rolled-up mattress because it was the Sabbath day. Referring to Jesus, the man said, "That man who healed me commanded me to do so." When asked, he could not identify or give description of Jesus. Everything happened too quickly. He was healed, and then Jesus simply disappeared into the crowd. Sometime later, the man encountered Jesus in the temple complex. Jesus warned him that unless he stopped sinning, something worse could happen to him. Jesus' comment about the man's sin seems uncharacteristic. I therefore conclude that either the reference was made to something in particular that Jesus knew about in connection with this man's past, or more probably that the man, being Jewish, had succumbed to adulterous involvement in Greek religious worship. In other words, Jesus' rough words to the man had something to do with the place where Jesus found him, the pool of Bethesda, the pool dedicated to the healing power of the Greek god Asclepius. While there may be other reasons, it seems that the man who was healed probably did not like Jesus' rebuke and went to the Udayoi to tell them about his healer's identity. Of course, it's possible that the man went out because of his sense of naivete, reporting that the great things God has done, as it were. But the natural reading of the story seems to indicate that the healed man reported Jesus to the authorities because of Jesus' early rebuke and warning against future idol worship. Verse 16. And this was why the Udayoi were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." The temple leadership heard of Jesus' rising popularity. Something happened, however, to incense them. Jesus did the unthinkable. He went to the Greek temple complex, where the god Asclepius was worshipped, or at least honored, by many common people in Judea seeking healing. Jesus declared his redeeming kingship over Israel by physically healing one of the lost sheep of Israel, thus demonstrating full authority over sickness, and like the Israelite prophets of old, putting to shame the false claims of pagan worshipers and those among God's people who had joined their beliefs in the condoning silence of approval. With this healing, the Udayoi's authority, popularity, and communal influence were threatened to the core by this unprecedented challenge issued by Jesus to the temple authority. This happens often in life. When a pioneer in any field takes a strong lead over other members, the challenged and threatened establishment attempts to launch an attack against the challenger's character. In this case, they attempted to disown what was most dear to Jesus himself in the context of his life, obedience to the Torah. The Jerusalemite authorities went after him, criticizing him regarding one of the most important things in the life of an everyday Judean, Sabbath observance. The goal was to discredit him by making him someone he was not, a Sabbath breaker. But there is more here than first meets the eye. In verse 16, we read, "This was why Udayoi were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath." In most interpretations of the story, the emphasis is placed on the Sabbath. So we understand that this was why the Udayoi were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But What if we were simply placing the emphasis on the wrong word? What if the sentence should instead be read, "This was why the Judaioi were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath"? In other words, the issue really was not that Jesus was not a Sabbath-observing Jew. The issue was that Jesus was demonstrating his incredible miracle-working power, which in turn demonstrated his unprecedented connection with the divine. The influence of the Judaioi was already jeopardized due to many other factors unrelated to Jesus, and now it was jeopardized even more. What Jesus did was simply not acceptable. Jesus had stepped into the abode of the god Asclepius and healed someone who had been sick for many, many years. In other words, the Jerusalem temple authorities knew that Jesus could not continue performing such powerful miracles without them, the Judaioi, the Judean authorities, losing their authority over the Jewish communities in Judea and abroad. So they falsely accused him of breaking the laws of the Holy Sabbath, a very serious offense which would surely disqualify anyone with a messianic claims or hopes. In other words, the Sabbath was not the reason for persecuting Jesus. It was their slanderous excuse. It was his miracles and prophetic words, not only in a distant Galilee, but especially the miracle in the nearby Asclepian in Judea. This miracle took place right next to the Jerusalem temple, and this threatened them to the core. In verse 17, we read that Jesus defended himself with a well-known Jewish traditional concept. God rested on the Sabbath day after the initial creation described in Genesis, but he had continued to work each Sabbath ever since. He endows children with human souls, brings them into the covenant relationship with him at the time of their circumcision. Jesus put it this way, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." The logic was very simple. If children are born on the Sabbath day, then it means that God works to give them life on the Sabbath day. If the children are allowed to be circumcised on the Sabbath, then surely God also works, making the covenant with them on the Sabbath. Therefore, Jesus' reasoning was already accepted by many Judaioi as a Jewish Torah observant opinion and an honorable lifestyle of a fellow practicing Jew. He was not saying anything new in that regard. Healing on the Sabbath was not something that violated the Torah, contrary to the objections of these Judaioi. As we will see shortly, the real problems were connected with Jesus' own claims. Not only did he claim general sonship of God, but he claimed to have a particularly close relationship with the Heavenly Father. He was his son, and therefore equal to God in some very important areas. This claim was rightly perceived by the Judaioi as threatening their standing in the community, their ability to lead, influence, and control. Regrettably, their leadership reached the conclusion that they must do something. Jesus was becoming too dangerous. Something needed to be done to discredit him and to stop the momentum he was gaining. At the threat of such a grave danger, almost anything seemed justified. Verse 18. This was why the Judaioi were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. How can this strong negative language toward Jesus be explained? After all, we read that the Judaioi sought to kill him. It is known that in the vast majority of murder cases, the actions of the murderer are based upon the feelings of anger that eventually lead to the murder itself. This is probably why Jesus taught that in some way anger toward a fellow human is the same as actual murder. When people become angry and continue to be very angry for a long time, they often cannot bear the heavy burden of their anger, but will seek to take some action to satisfy and nullify the anger that causes them so much emotional pain. They must end the pain that their own anger causes them. The stronger the anger, the stronger is the desire to end it. In the absence of a better way, people resort to evil actions such as violence and even murder. Incidentally, the word in Greek translated here as breaking the Sabbath does not need to be translated this way. It is equally possible to speak of Jesus, quote, setting the Sabbath free, end quote. It is not that the author of John thought Jesus was breaking the Sabbath. He, in fact, was persuaded that Jesus could not break a commandment of his own. John holds to high Christology, meaning that Jesus is the incarnation of the Lord God himself. So, by definition, Jesus could not be everything John said he was and at the same time be a Sabbath breaker. But in John's account, it was the Iudaioi who accused him of breaking the Sabbath, because they were seeking to discredit him in the eyes of the people whose heart allegiance they did not possess, but whose rebellion they still feared. Jesus' very presence, his person, as well as his teachings, his words, and his signs, his deeds, were spelling trouble for the Jerusalem temple elite and others who fed off the same budget and status. Jesus was gaining more and more popular following. He was performing miracles and giving prophetic speeches almost exclusively outside of Judea, the headquarters of the Iudaioi. As a matter of principle, he did not respond to their requests to submit to the authority. In this chapter, however, the anger and plans to kill Jesus are only beginning. They reach a crescendo when Jesus crosses the red line of the patience and tolerance of the Iudaioi. Jesus' final threat to the Iudaioi leadership will be his most spectacular miracle, the resurrection of a well-known and respected member of the Iudaioi, a man named Lazarus. We read in John chapter 11 that Jesus is coming to Bethany, very near Jerusalem, and resurrecting Lazarus resulted in two significant events. Many members of the Iudaioi placed their faith in Jesus. As a result, an emergency meeting of the top-level leadership was called. In John 11:47-48, we read, "The chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.'" We will look at this story in detail when we get to chapter 11, but for now it is clear that the accusations of the Iudaioi in this section did not have to do with Jesus' seemingly liberal Sabbath observance, but with his person, words, and deeds. It is not that his claims to be the Son of Man / Logos of God did not have a place in Judaism of the time, but simply that Jesus was not allowed to take that place. The Jerusalem leaders calculated that if things continued as they were, Jesus, with his prophetic speeches that were validated by his great miracles, would surely have put them out of a job. In the following sections, we will see how the roles of Jesus will merge two normally separate concepts, Son of God and Son of Man. Chiastic structure. We now come to a very interesting text in John 5:19-30. If you listen carefully, you may be surprised to find that I've taken such a long text for consideration, instead of diving into a number of smaller pieces as I have been doing. The reason is that in this text we encounter a clear and unquestionable, at least to my mind, example of an ancient form of literary design, a chiasm. One of the many functions of chiasm is to help the interpreter clearly see where the literal unit begins and where the unit is brought to a literary conclusion. The sentence, either word by word, or at the very least thought by thought, is repeated at the beginning and at the end of the literary unit. As we look into the Old Testament background of the theological statements clearly presented and highlighted in John 5:19-30, we are of course drawn to several key passages from the prophets. The prophetic words of Daniel in 12:2 and his earlier vision in chapter 7 are evoked. and play a major role in this text. Daniel 12:2, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt." Daniel 7:13-14, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." After reading both texts from Daniel, we see by the time of the writing of Daniel, there was already a clear prophetic hope and expectation concerning resurrection from the dead. A section of this text reminds us of a depiction of Israel's return from exile back to the Lord her God and to the land of Israel promised to her for an everlasting possession, Ezekiel 37. It is also a powerful image of the massive collective resurrection of the dead. Daniel's vision spoke of someone to whom Israel's God, the Ancient of Days, would give his own full legitimate authority. The figure of the Son of Man, commissioned in Daniel 7:14 to rule the world, is only literally fulfilled in the time of Jesus' ascension. In John 5:19-30, the texts cited from Daniel are then merged with the idea of the royal Son of God from Psalm 2. Narrator: "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Nations, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us." Narrator: "He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury." Heavenly King: "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." The Earthly King: "I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel." Narrator: "Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." Verse 31, "If I alone bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true." As we continue to journey together through this ancient world with Jesus, we will compare and pay special attention to obvious differences between the Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John. When we don't spend most of our time attempting to harmonize the Gospel accounts, surprising insights can emerge. Moreover, it is by highlighting the sometimes sharp differences between the accounts of Jesus' life that we encounter what otherwise has proven to be an enigmatic enterprise. Discovering John's original intention, context, and purpose for composing this gospel. This time, I would like to highlight one very important difference: the almost complete absence of the courtroom motif in the Synoptic Gospels and its dominance in the Gospel of John. The words "to witness" or "to testify" occur throughout John. Everything and everyone seem to be testifying on behalf of Jesus. In John 5:31, Jesus is reminding his accusers of how the testimony of witnesses was to function according to Mosaic legislation in ancient Israel. Jesus appeals to a Mosaic law summarized in Deuteronomy 17:6-7. "On the evidence of the two witnesses, or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Deuteronomy 19:15. A single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. There are other examples in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, that do not carry exclusively negative prosecuting connotations when it comes to using the principle of two or more witnesses. In Exodus 32:15, Moses calls the two stones upon which the Ten Commandments were engraved the tablets of the testimony. In the temple above the mercy seat, there were also two supreme witnesses, cherubim, who covered the ark of testimony with their wings. Verse 32. There is another who bears witness about me, and I know that the testimony that he bears about me is true. You sent to John, and he has borne witness to the truth. Not that the testimony that I receive is from man, but I say these things so that you may be saved. He was a burning and a shining lamp, and you were willing to rejoice for a while in his light. In this passage, Jesus will make a case that he has two witnesses to establish the veracity of his claims regarding his person and therefore his deeds and teachings. First is the lesser testimony of John the Baptist. Jesus continues to talk with the Eudaioi, recalling in verse 33 the Jerusalem formal inquiry into the ministry of John the Baptist. There we read, the Eudaioi sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" We can clearly see that Jesus is not debating with the Jewish people as such, but with the temple authorities and those who worked for them outside of the temple. We are introduced to the interesting fact that John's ministry was not rejected from the outset. In several ways, John looked like many other aspiring Jewish prophets who inspired followings and in the end were not themselves important. It is only when John's activity began to gain momentum that the investigation from Jerusalem was commissioned. Verse 36. But the testimony that I have is greater than that of John. For the works that the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I am doing, bear witness about me that the Father has sent me. And the Father who sent me has himself borne witness about me. His voice you have never heard, his form you have never seen, and you do not have his word abiding in you, for you do not believe the one whom he has sent. Secondly, the stronger witness to the person, deeds, and words of Jesus was the Lord, the covenant God of Israel himself. Jesus made a twofold argument from this point. Consider the incredible miracle-working power I have. That power is God's seal of approval. God's testimony is that the message that accompanies the manifestation is indeed also true. While the baptismal event is not recorded in John, it was no doubt already part of Jesus' tradition. The heavens were opened and God's voice thundered from above, echoing the words of Psalm 2. We read, related to this theme, a passage in Luke 7, 18-22. The disciples of John reported all these things to him, and John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to the Lord, saying, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And when the men had come to him, they said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, 'Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?'" In that hour, he healed many people of diseases and plagues and evil spirits, and on many who were blind, he bestowed sight. And he answered them, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have good news preached to them." We read in another related passage, incidentally, also in Luke 3, 21-22, "Now when all people were baptized, and when Jesus also had been baptized and was praying, the heavens were opened, and the Holy Spirit descended on him in bodily form, like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, 'You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased.'" Verse 39, "You research the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is they that bear witness about me. Yet you refuse to come to me so that you may have life. I do not receive glory from people, but I know that you do not have the love of God within you." It is possible that we have long misinterpreted this verse. You may ask, what is there to misinterpret? Jesus says that he does not seek praise from people, but only from God himself. It is pure and simple, and knowing the grammatical nuances of Greek, Aramaic, and Hebrew languages would not change the message. Well, it's true that in this case, knowing linguistics would not help, but knowing the background of the New Testament would. During the Second Temple period, in addition to Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, Samaritans, there were other Israelite groups. Sometime later, some rabbis derogatorily referred to a group that is of a particular interest to us here as the people of the land. These were the Israelites who were the dominant people group in Lower Galilee. They did not engage heavily with the teachings of the authorities in Jerusalem, and even if they were learned, they were not considered as such by the elitist standards of the Judaoi. When we look, especially in John's Gospel, for the type of person who accepted Jesus' authority and supported his ministry, we reach an obvious conclusion. Jesus was largely rejected in Judea, but largely accepted in Jewish Galilee. Since Judea was dominated by the Judaoi and Jewish Galilee by the Israelite Am Haaretz, the people of the land, we conclude that it is entirely possible that Jesus was not referring to people as a whole, but to the people among whom he was quickly becoming a major celebrity. These people were the Jewish Galilean people of the land. Throughout the Gospel of John, you will recall that the Judaoi challenged Jesus to submit his ministry to their approval. Jesus consistently refused. In this section, Jesus leveled a strong critique against the Judaoi, explaining his reasons for not honoring their authority. They accused him of accepting approval from the people of the land instead of from them. Jesus, however, expressed his non-acceptance of their authority in verses 43 to 47. Let us see what he said. Verse 43. "I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, you will receive him." The second part of this verse, "if another comes in his own name, you will receive him," has been interpreted to be a reference to the coming of Antichrist. Even if this is a new thought for you, you can see how this idea might be relevant in this context. However, I do not think it is possible to confidently state what Jesus was referring to here. There is another possibility that has been largely overlooked. In Jesus' time, the concept of the wicked priest was known among Essene-influenced Israelites. Writings regarding the wicked priest are well represented in the Qumran collection. Presumably, the Qumranite Israelite residents, who left Jerusalem in protest and established the headquarters of the Israelite Essene movement in the Judean desert a century before Jesus, were persecuted by this wicked priest of Jerusalem Temple. The wicked priest may have been a symbolic figure representing all high priestly figures. The Essenes also had a figure they called the Teacher of Righteousness, who was the oppositional counterpart to the figure of the wicked priest. We read about both of them in the Qumranite commentary on the book of Habakkuk. "Because of the blood of man and the violence done to the land, to the city, and all its inhabitants." interpreted, this concerns the wicked priest whom God delivered into the hands of his enemies because of the iniquity committed against the teacher of righteousness and the man of his counsel, that he might be humbled by means of a destroying scourge in bitterness of soul because he had done wickedly to his elect. Among many other references, we find this passage. The arrogant man seized wealth without halting. He widens his gullet like hell, like death he has never enough. All the nations are gathered to him, and all the peoples are assembled to him. Interpreted, this concerns the wicked priest who was called by the name of truth when he first arose. But when he ruled over Israel, his heart became proud. He forsook God and betrayed the precepts for the sake of riches. He robbed and amassed the riches of men of violence who rebelled against God, and he took the wealth of the people, heaping sinful iniquity upon himself. Theories as to the identity and dating of both of these figures vary greatly. There is certainly no consensus. There is, however, an influential theory that the wicked priest is a composite figure who includes a series of various wicked priests whose administration of the Jerusalem temple covered several centuries. Though one cannot be certain, I speculate here that it is possible that Jesus referred either to present or past events involving the wicked priest or priests. Remember, Jesus was very familiar with the Essene movement and no doubt was aware of these interpretations. Verse 44. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? Jesus' argument is simple. How can I trust you, the Iudaioi, to make a judgment about me if you yourself need each other's approval to remain in power? His point is also simple. There is a conflict of interest. A judge who stood to lose or gain, or was in some way personally connected with a case, would be disqualified because he would not be thought able to judge righteously. Jesus strongly criticized the entire temple establishment, particularly its leadership and its administration. Those leaders were in danger of losing their position and authority. It was logical, therefore, for Jesus to refuse to submit to their judgment. Verse 45. Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe in his writings, how will you believe my word? Jesus justified and defended himself, but he was also consistent. He did not come to condemn those whose evil was clearly exposed by the light of his person, words, and deeds. He insisted that judgment was not his role. His job was to save and not to condemn. The chief prosecutor of Israel has long since been appointed by God of Israel himself. His name was Moses.